RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with royal designers.
Back in the 19th century, during the height of the Industrial Revolution, the structural engineer was king and involved with an astonishing and challenging array of achievements, both above, on, and below the ground. As the world progressed into the 20th century, a new breed of modernist architects came to the fore, eclipsing the engineer in the public's consciousness. But in post-war Britain, a new firm of structural engineers appeared on the scene, in the shape of Ovarup, and with it, a more collaborative philosophy. It would quickly develop as the go-to structural engineers for the more adventurous architects, dedicated to pushing the boundaries of possibilities. For the past 37 years, my guest today, Tristram Carfrae, has worked on some of the world's most iconic projects, from the Sydney Opera House to the Schlumberger Research Lab in Cambridge, and the Pavilion of the Future at the Seville Expo, to the Garden Bridge in London. As an early exponent of computer-generated design, Tristram was instrumental in forging an ever closer collaboration with architects in the digital age. Tristram's work has earned him many awards, including the 2014 Gold Medal from the Institute of Structural Engineers for his wonderfully elegant design for the Beijing Olympic Aquatic Center, a beautiful, translucent, glowing cube of bubbles. He now holds the position as joint chairman of Arup, where he helps guide the global firm to ever innovative areas. But he is still very close to the coalface, never happier when being challenged with a difficult nut to crack. In the recent BBC documentary, The Brits Who Built the Modern World, it highlighted Tristram's creative collaboration with many of the country's most outstanding architects, including Norman Foster, Richard Rogers, Nicholas Grimshaw, Michael Hopkins, and Terry Farrell. I spoke to Tristram at Arup's London headquarters. I was curious to know why he has remained at Arup since leaving university.
I joined Arup in 1981, and yes, I have never been anywhere else.
Is that unusual in this?
It's unusual, I think, in the world today, but it's not unusual in Arup. A lot of us fall in love with Arup, and we can't imagine being anywhere else.
Presumably because of its history and reputation.
It's A, the history and reputation, but it's more the philosophical basis on which Ovarup set up the company. So
Right. We
are essentially a cooperative. We are own ourselves. We share all our profits evenly across the whole firm. But there's also a set of aims that I've set down that we still stick to today, which gives us a reason for being.
And I'm going to talk about those a little bit later as well. Now, let's roll back to your childhood. Where were you born?
I was born actually in Morden in South London, but from 6 months old, I spent the rest of my life in Devon.
So I do detect still a little bit of a twang.
Yeah, if I need to, I can.
Now, I understand that your mother was an architect.
Yes.
And what sort of influence did she have on you? Because I think you did at one point think architecture, and she said, no, you're not art enough, is that?
That is absolutely correct. So at the age of 16, I thought I would like to be an architect. I was choosing my A-levels, and I thought, I wanted to do art, maths and physics, and thought architecture might be a future profession. And she said, no, dear, your art is nowhere near good enough in the creative world.
Encouraging for your mum.
But she did say prophetically, you should go and study engineering. Her father was an engineer. And then work for a company like Ovarup & Partners that obviously cares about architecture.
And what about your dad? What did he do?
My dad was, he was a man without a mission. So he started his life in the army, a professional soldier, and suffered, of course, the Second World War. And then became an English teacher. So he was interested in literature and nature.
And so what about you academically as a younger person? Did you have any sort of particular leanings at that point? I know you mentioned architecture, but were you sort of generally creative or...?
More mathematically gifted, I think. I stood out as, always topping the maths tests. I seemed to be very good at examinations, rather better than I should have been, if you see what I mean.
So you were a quick crammer. You can sort of retain information, rather like barristers can actually scan a lot of complex documents and literally have it in their head for a few days.
Particularly numerical, and I found later particularly numerical that relates to physical. So
Right. When
I got into abstract maths, either pure maths or even into electromagnetic theory or things that weren't tangible, I found it more of a struggle.
Right.
But as long as it was the maths behind physics, how things work,
yeah,
I was always pretty good at it.
So you ended up actually studying mechanical sciences at Cambridge.
Yes.
And I think while you were there, you were offered a place here, subject to your grades. Is that right?
Yeah. Luckily, not subject to.
Not subject.
No, it was a straight offer, which was fortunate because I think the prediction was I was going to get a better degree than I did. So luckily, I got the job at that time. But it was coincidental. I applied to three different firms. I decided I liked the structural side of engineering.
Yeah.
Because at Cambridge, you study the whole width, all yeah. aspects of engineering.
Yeah.
I decided the structural bit was me.
Yeah.
I applied to three firms, a very small one, a middle-sized one, and an Arab that was the big one. And then went to interviews at all three.
Right.
Two offered me positions. The small one said they weren't taking anybody on at that time.
Right.
And chose Arab because they seemed to give you a better introduction to actually doing things. And the other one were quite clear that the new person starts as a T-boy and works their way up.
Right. So you joined here in 81, yes?
81.
81. Yep. And I think, as with probably, because it's a large firm, you attend seminars and inductions and so forth. And I think you opted to work in what was then relatively new area of lightweight structures, or at least you sort of had a seminar or got involved in some way at that point. And also, you, from what I understand, you were a sort of early exponent at seeking out what the computer might be able to do and sort of VDU units,
yes.
which nobody seen, because it's the early days of really the use of that sort of equipment.
No, exactly. So I as you write, we did a 1 week what they call the graduate induction course, when we sort of cramming what ARUP is all about and what opportunities there might be. And one of them was the man slightly crazy professor who led the lightweight structures unit, which had two people in it, said that they wanted a graduate to come and join them. And, asked for volunteers, describe what it was all about.
That was here?
Here. And I was one of 15 who volunteered, and luckily I was chosen. Actually, curiously and sort of funnily, I found out later why I was chosen. They decided I knew a lot about designing steelwork. And steelwork is the other component of a lightweight structure, is fabric. Architectural fabric, tension fabric, and steelwork. Actually, all I'd said is I knew nothing about concrete. Actually, I knew nothing about either material because at Cambridge you were taught very theoretically, as you know, without much practical knowledge at all. But anyway, I got the gig, and Alistair was developing, computer programs. So it was at that time we did what's called form finding, just discerning the shape of a lightweight structure using physical models. So using soap films stretched between wire frames or lady stockings stretched between
points.
So
the classic models, or slightly eccentric, but the old-fashioned way.
Yes, and then you take a photograph of the model and then you measure off the photograph to work out what the shape was.
Right.
So Alistair had developed a computer technique to simulate this numerically. So it was slightly strange because we could do all this in using teletypes, typing into the computer and getting back lists and lists of numbers.
Yeah.
But of course, it was then quite difficult to go to your architect and say, look, this is the shape we've got, and give them a whole list of numbers.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. It didn't mean anything.
No.
So then I found that we had a VDU, a colour VDU, what's more, sitting in a computer group that somebody persuaded Arup to purchase and had never been used. So I thought, well, this is the answer. If I can get my numbers onto the screen in colour and actually do a graphical representation of what the numbers mean, then then we can start having a conversation with our collaborators, clients, architects, etc. And it worked.
Well, I think from what I also have gathered reading about you, that nothing really much happened, in terms of lightweight structures. No jobs occurred. And you then found yourself moving on to working on the Richard Rogers Lloyd's building with alongside Peter Rice, who famously was responsible for the large sail roof structure of the Sydney Opera House.
Yes, exactly. So, we've a year of doing computer programming without any project. We did concept after concept after concept, but none came to fruition.
Yeah.
I moved into a mainstream engineering group, but happened to be the Lloyd's team. with Peter Rice.
That must have been for you as a young guy, you know, because that was one of the iconic buildings of the 20th century for all sorts of things, highly controversial, lots of new things going on, and you were working with one of the great engineers. So it must have been a fantastic learning curve for you.
It was phenomenal. I mean, working with Peter, we got to work, well, I also worked with Norman Foster via Jack Zuntz's patronage, because that was because of the computer graphics. Norman was intrigued by the new technique, so I had to go along and show that off.
The golden boy of computer graphics at the time.
At the time, for a couple of years, it was, and that was great because I worked with then with Peter, with Richard Rogers, and also with Renzo Piano, and really to be able to work with the three of the greatest architects of the day, and still today, the greatest architects of the world, in your first 2 years of your professional life was just phenomenal. And then straight after that, I returned to the Lightweight Structures Group because we got a real job.
You did, which I think is the Michael Hopkins Schlumberger. Exactly. So, I was going to ask you about it, which is another iconic century architecture using this coated woven glass fiber fabric, which was, it was just astonishing. I remember passing that. You'd see it from the motorway, sort of rather like a strange space station. It was just and it still looks pretty fantastic.
And today they're developing the Northwest Cambridge site, or the West Cambridge site actually next to it, all new engineering departments and other buildings, and it's still held up as a reference. We want buildings of this quality.
And are you working on that, or the firm is working on
that? We are working on some of it.
Some parts of it. So then comes, you've got so many projects that I can't, go into all of them, but I'll just cherry pick some as we go along. But by the mid-80s, I think you were working with Norman Foster on the BBC radio headquarters. Is that right?
That was actually straight after the Schlumberger experience. And that was where the computer graphics came in.
Right.
But unfortunately, although we won the project, it was a design competition, it didn't last. We worked on it for a year and then it stopped. So it was going to be based at where the Langham Hotel is.
That's right, I assume that you became rather disheartened at that point because you sort of started thinking about, well, I want to go and work in another country. Hong Kong was your first choice.
Yes, this is rather naive of me, not knowing the world. So I was brought up not just in Devon, but in rural Devon. Our house was four square in the country, surrounded by fields.
Yeah.
It was a rectory where some rector had gone a bit mad and built this house on top of a hill. But it was beautiful, But I found living in London, and then of course I went from there to Cambridge, which is also idyllic, in its surroundings and so on. But I found the nitty gritty, London urban experience just a little bit tough.
Yes.
And so I suggested to my then boss, I'd like to go and work somewhere else, and see what some other cities might be like. And I said Hong Kong, and he looked at me and he said, "If you can't take London,
Well, that's pretty packed, Hong Kong.
You're going to have no chance in Hong Kong." And he suggested Sydney.
Was it Hong Kong because architecturally it was becoming interesting?
I knew we had a large office there, there were opportunities, really. Yeah. It was more,
So you ended up in Sydney working on the roof of the football stadium,
yes,
first of all. And also something else very significant happened there.
Yes, I met my future wife through Arab. So
is she an engineer?
No, but her father was an architect on the Opera House.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so he and my boss, John Nutt, knew each other well from the Opera House. And they were both sailors. And we met sailing.
See, well, in the harbour.
In the harbour, yeah. Well, so, it's sort of slightly fairy tale,
So you ended up coming back with your wife. And I think you joined up again with Peter Rice on a 3-year stint working with him. And then you decided you wanted to go back to Australia.
Yes. And again, that was more personal. So I had a wonderful 3 years with Peter, and it was heartbreaking for us to sort of part company.
What were you doing with him in those 3 years?
So the major projects were the Bari Football Stadium with Renzo Piano for the World Cup in Italy. We did work in the old port of Genoa to celebrate the Christopher Columbus 400 years, I think it was. And then we were working on the Seville Expo granite, pre-stressed stone granite facade in Spain with Bogus Mackey, or David Mackey in particular.
Right.
And so, I thought we were doing... Peter preferred to work directly with younger people.
Mm.
He didn't like, the experienced engineers who may have other ideas.
Did he think your younger ones were more pliable?
Well, Yes, and it gave him more freedom to be more creative right. by joining directly.
Injecting
yes.
the younger thoughts.
And it was a time where computers, again, were coming to the fore in structural analysis, in lighting design, in computational fluid dynamics for mechanical engineering. Yeah. It was all happening. In my memory, you know, the late 80s were a complete buzz, very exciting. But we had a baby and decided that it would be better for all of us to be near my in-laws. And we thought Sydney was actually a better place for children to grow up. So it was back to this. Sydney, you see, has sea and beaches and bushland and city
all in one place.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. But I think you spent a rather... Maybe it sounded to me anyway a little bit of a depressing 6 months in Japan trying to drum up work because it was a rather flat period.
Yes, it doesn't. I don't think it was depressing. It was hard.
Yeah,
we hadn't realised how difficult life would be with a 5-month-old baby in a country where the culture is completely alien. You can't speak the language and you can't read the writing. You know that was a difficult. But actually, we look back on it with great fondness because it was so alien. We learned so much.
That is the wonderful thing about Japan. It is very Japanese because it's. I think it is 90% Japanese.
Yes, and certainly then it was. And we.
I think it still is, isn't it?
It's changed a bit. But we were determined to have an office in Japan. We thought it was an important place for architecture and for engineering. The big contractors, if you remember the day, were spreading their wings around the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, my job was to help form that practice, which we successfully did, and we still have it.
So, back in, Australia, that was it. Now, you were in Australia now for a long period of time, weren't you?
For the next 10 years,
So whilst you were there, what were you principally sort of establishing, the Australian office?
Well, the Australian office was well established. It was quite easy in a way just to follow in the footsteps of John Nutt and Peter Thompson, who led the practice, you know, generating architectural design. I was warned before I went there that the Australians are tough, they're merciless, they're blunt. They care a lot for economy, perhaps ahead of aesthetics.
Right.
But that was a fantastic training ground because you had to do both. You had to make things leaner and meaner and better.
And you found that a good creative challenge.
I did. And I looking back, I developed a really good relationship with Philip Cox, even though he was 20 years my senior, which started with the football stadium the first time I went to Australia. Yeah. And we one third of the projects... I had done up until I returned to the UK in 2010 were with Philip Cox.
Do you find as a designer, my era is graphic design, so it's much more immediate. But I find, I've always found that when I'm limited, it's slightly more magical.
Yes. No.
Do you know what I mean? Because if you've got all the box of tricks and then somebody says, no, you can't have those, it concentrates the mind. And often wonderful things come out of the necessity of having to economise.
It's a very interesting point, Mike, particularly for engineers. Engineers are actually problem solvers, ultimately, and they prefer to be completely constrained. Their mathematical background is here is a very, very difficult mathematical puzzle for which there is only one answer, and your job is to find it. And they find the real world, where there's an infinite number of possibilities, quite daunting because they're not quite sure which direction to go. So actually putting constraints... In this case, let's say a client's brief plus an architectural vision plus a whole set of rules and regulations you have to comply with helps most engineers get creative and get excited because you're now got, you now know what the rules are.
I want to talk a little bit about relationships because the very nature of what you do means enormous amount of collaboration across many disciplines. And I know that this firm is multidisciplinary, so you are... involved with all aspects of creating something, including architecture.
Yes.
But a lot of your work obviously comes from major architects. And I just wondered about the relationship. The traditional view with many people is the architects are the front of house people bowing to the audiences and the engineers are behind the curtain, making all the things work. And that wasn't the way in the Victorian period where the engineers were the people in front of the curtain. You know, they were the ones saying, Brunel and et cetera, were all there doing the thing. I wondered, when did that change?
Well, I can only say it changed long before my day. So
yes.
So it did change. There are some theories that changed around. It changed profoundly during the Second World War. So this is one theory, and I don't know how much I believe it, but when engineers became so proficient at killing people, if you like, or providing the means to kill people, including ultimately the atom bomb, then society became a little bit distrustful of technical achievement. But at the same time, we had aviation, which, of course, was changing everybody's life in a positive fashion. Yes. So I'm not sure I completely believe that theory. But certainly what holds us back today is that the world is a world of opinion, I think. With Twitter, it's even more so. We're post-factual in some senses, whereas engineers find it very difficult to have an opinion which they can't rely on evidence to prove it. Right. We only like speaking up when we have the research or the documentation or the numerical or whatever that underpins, you know, what we're about to say. We don't just like having an opinion. And I think in the world of the last 50 years, that means engineers have receded somewhat, at least in the public view, because we don't write opinion.
Okay, well, that brings on very nicely to something where I think you were very personally involved, particularly in solving a real sort of issue, which was the Beijing National Aquatic Center, the water cube, which was described by Marie Claire magazine as one of the world's 101 most sexy things.
Yes.
Now, this was adjacent to the Bird's Nest stadium, which is, I think, also involved Arup and Ai Weiwei, I think, created the original idea of the concept of a Bird's Nest. And you had this circle and square connection, which I know is a very Chinese thing, you know, the air and the earth or whatever. Yes. But you ended up with this sort of cube, this beautiful blue cube, which is illuminated. But you had all sorts of major problems that you wanted to solve. Maybe could you just talk through the concept from the beginning? Because I think it's such an interesting story.
It's a project that's given me the most, I think, personal satisfaction and fulfillment. So thank you for for choosing that one. So we were in a design competition, you know, with the world's best, and we felt from Australia, because we were teamed up with an Australian firm of architects and a Chinese firm of engineers and architects, that we were in the design sense the underdogs, you know, the unknown. You know, we were up against the Norman Foster, etc., of, you know, all known players. So we decided we had to come up with something, you know, pretty special. That was the ambition. But actually the architects, the Chinese architects and the Australian architects, couldn't agree what that special was. All they could agree was it had to be a physical manifestation of something to do with water, because the Chinese love, you know, direct representation. And so one lot were looking at icebergs, the other one lot of architects were looking at waveforms. So, you know, it was...
So enter...
And we managed to walk down the middle. Yeah, yes. In effect, yes.
Yes.
And one of the graphical people at the Australian architects had drawn a picture with bubbles, you know, with the idea, literally, and even bubbles coming off the building, you know, sort of thing, literally bubles.
And rather like soap bubbles that are kids would blow.
That's it.
That hold together.
Yeah. And then the other thing was somebody had a photograph of a piece, I now know it's a microscopic photograph of polyurethane foam. But I looked at that and said, I have no idea what that structure is. It looks like a natural structure.
Yeah.
In fact, it wasn't. It was artificial, but it was affected. The same thing occurs in nature. And I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, how would structure inhabit space? That was the question I asked myself, because we'd already decided that we needed two skins of ETFE to heat the thing, and to make it sufficiently insulative that we didn't lose all the heat overnight. So the idea is to get the solar gain in during the day and then trap it to heat the swimming pools.
And this is very delicate material, isn't it?
Very delicate.
Vulnerable.
Yes, but I thought if we could put the ETFE bubbles straight onto a structural item without any secondary members, any purlins or mullions or cladding system, we just had structure and pillows.
Yeah.
You know, it would be very efficient, very cost-effective, because the budget was quite limited for the whole building. So cut a long story short, it's very complicated, but I ended up devising, sort of back-analysing what that geometry of that foam was, because somebody had done some research recently at Trinity College Dublin, and it turned out to be the geometry which solved a 100-year-old problem from Lord Kelvin, which was how do you subdivide three-dimensional space most efficiently? And that's the same answer as what's an infinite array of soap bubbles look like.
Right.
So it all came together.
Yes.
You know, and we put on the table at one meeting, it was 4 weeks into the design competition, halfway through, where we're still talking about icebergs and waves.
Right.
We put on the table this box made of a structure which represented bubbles, clad in ETFE pillows that looked like bubbles.
And this was a 3D?
3D, yes. 3D. I'd done it all in a 3D graphics because I'd kept that side of my life going.
Useful.
I actually took a day off work and did it all at home. Came in the next day and said, what about this? And at the same time, simultaneously and coincidentally, the day before, they had published the first sketches of the bird's nest as being the design for that. Even though it was being done by Arab, it was again in a competition. We didn't know what the winning design was going to be.
Yes,
yes. So we saw the red round thing.
Yeah.
And we got this idea of the blue square thing made of bubbles.
Perfect relationship.
And everybody got behind it. It was one meeting, 20 people around a table. Decisions were made, and that's what we did.
So you must have been thrilled to bits.
Yes.
And then to see it to its final...
And actually, we said the only challenge now is to build what we've designed, which had a whole lot of other issues, but we got through them all. And that's if you compare the competition drawings with the as-built building, they are indiscernibly different.
Really?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit, I'm interested about the relationship then with other disciplines. So
yes.
you've created you've designed the look and the structure and the now the lighting design aspect of it. Do you have an influence on that?
Absolutely.
Or do you bring in people that you feel are.
So I sort of work at in a way four different levels.
Yeah.
One is helping lead Arup and its direction and strategy.
Yeah.
One is having relationships with clients, architects and or property related clients who want broad, and that's between projects.
Yeah.
Then the other two, the real important ones, one is I lead multidisciplinary design teams.
Yes.
Where I'm trying to understand what the lighting issues are, what the fire engineering issues are, what the structural issues are, what the heating and energy issues are, etc., and pull it all together and be an interpreter between our massive team, often 30 different disciplines, and the architect and the client. And then lastly, I like doing the structural engineering hands-on.
You do?
Yeah.
Well, talking of the structural engineering, this is another project, and I don't think the structural part of the structural side had been decided already, and that's the now controversial and looks like it's not going to happen, Garden Bridge.
Yes.
It's very sad because it looked as if it was going to be wonderful. Interviewed Dan Pearson some time ago, and he was very excited because he was going to do all the planting, and obviously Thomas, so it was a kind of group of RDIs that were all going to be sort of, that would be a great thing. What do you know what the position is? It's not going to happen, is it?
It's not yet completely dead, but, if I'm a betting person, I'd go 50-50 that would be the best.
So what happens in a case like that where the architecture firm come to you and they've worked out more or less how it's going to look in terms of, support and so forth? What are you left to do, really?
Well, we still have to make it all work, and and for big projects like that, how to build it becomes a very dominant issue. So there's still an awful lot of work, even if the form is relatively fixed. And I should say here that sometimes we get given forms which are quite willful and almost impossible to make work structurally, and the issue is to try and make them work. That's that sort of there is only one possible way of doing it type problem.
Yeah.
Thomas's form was a very elegant, natural structure. There was no effort required to make it work, if you saw what I mean.
I do. I mean, he's...
It worked.
He is...
so there was no...
He's a unique...
Yes, so there was little for us to bring to the table in that regard because we already had a design that worked. So it's then, how do you build it? How do you make it most efficient? Yeah. I think we suggested the material. Thomas wanted something that was warm, that was robust, that he could take the bridge right down into the river without having a caisson or an exposed structure in the water. He wanted just the bridge to go into the water.
Right. So rather than one of those big booty looking.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
But that means you have to find a material that can live in the water, live in the tidal zone, and live up in the air equally. And that actually was quite a. That's where we brought our material scientists to bear and ended up with this idea of a cupronickel, which is used for ship's propellers, for example.
Oh, right.
But never before used on buildings or bridges.
So that sort of thing is must be rather exciting.
Exactly.
Having to discover, as you said at the beginning, you have to find new materials that are going to work in different environments.
So that's at one end. On the other end, you know, in the end, this is a massive plant pot. So what are the requirements for the plants?
Yes.
You know, and again, Dan knows some of that, but not all of it.
No.
And again, our landscape architects come in from the technical side.
Yeah.
You know, how much soil do we need? Should it be interconnected? What vents do we need? How are the plants going to be supported? Are they going to be blown away or, you know, out in the river? Or,
exactly.
And so there's all that side of life as well.
Yeah.
And so every project has its own unique challenges, and there's always plenty for a creative engineer to get their teeth into.
There are also examples, I think, maybe you can give me some, where an architect will come to you and he'll, with a literally back of an envelope, you know, I've got this sort of idea, and you look at it and you think there's no way that that's going to stand up or whatever, or you might refine it and make it even more beautiful. And that's the aspect of the engineer that interests me. The collaboration where two people become three. You know, you basically add to the party something special.
And this comes to relationships. So just yesterday I was in Santander for the official opening of the Bottin Centre, which is a Renzo Piano design art gallery on the waterfront at Santander that we've been working on for the last 5 years.
Mm.
And there, I've now worked with Renzo and other people at Arapa worked with Renzo now for more than 30 years. And so we know what we're trying to do together. We know what the outcome we're seeking is, if you see what I mean. And we have enough trust, you know, that if I say structurally, Renzo, we can't actually do that. Or if we do that, that's going to be quite fat, you know, and that, I don't think it'll give you what you're actually looking for. But if we did this, you know, we might get closer to what you're trying to achieve. And he'll say, yes, but there are other things I'm trying to do as well, Tristram, and actually we should be maybe doing this. And it's a dialogue all the way through. But everybody is caring about the final product being as good as it can be.
I think, you know, a similar area, if you like, of creativity with this vast array of collaboration is probably the making of a movie.
Yes.
When you have the single vision of the director, but actually the cinematographer, the art director, the costume design, all of those things, have got to work in harmony, and be guided. Great cinematographer will make the film look great.
Yeah.
Bad cinematographer will make it look awful.
No, I think that's a good analogy. The most extreme, I think, my time with working with Philip Cox in Australia on one project, the Brisbane Convention Exhibition Centre, I remember very clearly, we started by dialogue, not by sketching. And, and it was, what are we trying to achieve collectively? What would good look like from an engineering perspective? What would good look like from an architectural perspective in words rather than in shape or form? And that's very interesting.
Interested in this aspect of the organisation called One World, which is kind of Arup's philosophy. I think working in, it's a sort of think tank, thinking about the wider society and the various needs in the world. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yes, I think over my time at Arup, the last 40 years, or nearly 40 years, we were very much the engineers who worked with architects to produce, brilliant buildings. And we still do that, of course, and a lot of us are still very passionate about doing that. But meanwhile, we've extended to the design of major pieces of infrastructure, if you like, public service, railways, waterways, water systems, energy supply, all that sort of thing. And now we talk a lot about the cities. How do you create an urban realm which is good as it can be? And it's not just about the physicality of the urban realm, it's about communities and resilience and how do they survive and thrive. What is it that ultimately that people want? Why do cities exist? Why do people come together? And increasingly, more and more and more. Cities are growing. The amount of amount of people living in cities increases every year compared to the people who live outside cities. And there's a huge challenge here, Mike. We've got, if you take the demographic projections of getting to 9 billion people by the end of this century, at which time more than half of them are living in cities, and I think it's about 75% by then. We have to build more city between now and then than currently exists. It's a huge, you know, let alone improve the existing city. So we've got...
And that, of course, means going up.
It may mean going up. Up is a difficult one. It means becoming dense.
Yeah.
People have to live at a reasonable density so that all the service...
As they do in Japan, that we talked about earlier.
Actually, they do sufficiently density in London too.
Yeah.
London, Vienna, there are a lot, you know, Paris, all New York, Manhattan.
Yes.
All these cities are sufficiently dense without high-rise.
Yeah.
And at the other end, you've got Hong Kong, which is even denser, with tons of high-rise.
And ridiculously hot.
What we can't have is the sprawling suburbs of America or Australia.
Right,
you mean, or even the outskirts,
like LA, that just goes on forever.
Or even the outskirts of London.
Yeah.
We have to become denser to get the servicing, you know, efficiently to all the people, if you like.
You've said something that I found interesting. You said, I think it was you that said this, we need to join the debate on what people want rather than telling people what they need.
Yes.
Now, that interests me because I think, you know, often architects have been criticised for really concentrating on their vision, and, you know, basically the people come second. And there are lots of examples of real, you know, gaffes made in universities where, you know, the idea of chance encounters between different faculties has been completely ignored because they just have separate entrances, whatever. So the human touch, and I remember reading many years ago Christopher Alexander's book, The Timeless Way of Building, and also Brand's book, How Buildings Learn. And that was all about kind of human-centered buildings about people. And I think Stuart Brand's view at the time was that if an architect builds a building that disagrees with the people, they will, by their force of will, ultimately change it.
Yes.
Do you...
I completely agree, but... Yeah, for me, it's you know, if we really sort of distill it down to its simplest, if you like, or the essence of what we're trying to do as designers of the built environment, it's to improve people's experience at the minimal cost.
Yes.
Right? But then the experience bit comes at least in two parts, probably in far more. There's an emotional experience, which is where art and form and light and space, you know, really play a part.
Yeah.
And there's a functional experience. It's got to operate. It's got to meet people's basic needs. You know, they've got to be able to get in and out of the front door and, you know, and get around the building, etc. Mm. And work for the businesses, you know, that might occupy it.
Yeah.
And at the cost side, you've got the financial cost, obviously. That's the easy one. But you've also got the cost of time, how long it takes to do, the cost of materials, and the cost of resources on the planet.
Yes.
So we've got the whole ecological and environmental, and then the cost of energy, you know, and its usage and how it's made and climate change and so on. So we've got, in this very simple formula, there are a huge number of dimensions. That's it.
Think about,
above and below.
Well, just a couple of more questions. I think we're coming to the end. Talking about that very thing, you know, obviously, sadly, in the news recently, we had this disaster at a high rise. And I know that that's... those sort of buildings are not in the domain of ours, but nevertheless, the idea of, you know, the cladding was added to these buildings. I gather this morning I heard on the news that there's a chain of hotels that have used exactly the same cladding, and they're all panicking, of course. Yep. The whole notion of safety in buildings is obviously is going to become increasingly an issue, particularly about the many high-rise properties that are now are being built in London. Very expensive, you know. £2-3 million apartments. I mean, how does this sort of thing happen is really what I'm asking you. Is it cutting corners and shoddy suppliers, or, you know, it just seems extraordinary that this could, I know it's a rarity, but it's such a horrific thing when it does happen.
It's a very difficult question, Mike, and I can't comment, I don't wish to comment, if you like, on this particular matter.
Yeah,
it's too fresh and the evidence is not yet, you know, fully before us. So, but more basically, it's very hard. You know, we think the regulators should be able to control everything, you know, that we have regulations and codes of practice and standards and so on, and they should cover everything. They never can, you know, and in the end it comes down to the determination of the design team to try and take everything into account. But as new things happen, so if, for example, there's a new type of insulation available, you know, somebody might use it without realizing the consequences of using it, because they might be specifying it to get a better thermal performance, to reduce the energy consumption, you know, with all the best will in the world to try and reduce climate change, without realizing that the fire risk that might come with that specification. Yeah. So for me, it's all, and in our work at Arup, it is all about trying to take all those risks, you know, into account simultaneously. And it is, but people think it should all be obvious, it all should all be logical, it should all be rational, it's all calculable, and why haven't we taken it into account? The real world is so complex that a lot of it is intuition, judgment, hunch, and experience, you know, and it's not actually down to doing all the sums.
No, of course.
It's down to, you know, looking at it and saying, hang on, you know, that's wrong. If we did that, you know, we're going to end up, you know, potentially in trouble, regardless of the regulations, regardless of the client's brief, and only because people talk to each other and understand the consequences of each other's work.
Okay, well, let's are there any areas of work that you'd love to tackle, but you've never yet had the opportunity?
I'll deflect that question a little bit, Mike. Just to say that I've been involved the last 3 years with helping to design the next stages, and hopefully the final stages, of the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona.
Yes.
And the pleasure I get from that project is just phenomenal. So
that is, been going on forever since he died, of course, run over by a tram or something.
Yes.
But, and I've been there, and it is a remarkable place. And I'm sure for any engineer or architect or designer to work on it, to be part of it.
Yes.
Must be. So what are you doing exactly?
So you may or may not know that the original design for Sagrada Familia was a totally different church by a different architect.
I didn't know that.
No, a fellow called Villar started the project in 1880,
right,
or thereabouts, and the crypt was already under construction before Villar fell out with his client and Gaudi was appointed instead. Gaudi, of course, changed the above-ground structure to something two or three times larger, and one of his towers, the one that represents Mary, the Mother of God, sits upon the crypt vertically, and the crypt never, when it was built, never envisaged this massive weight of a tower sitting on it. So we got involved when, so the last 40 years, originally they built it in traditional masonry construction. The last 40 years it's been built mainly in reinforced concrete with stone cladding, because they decided it had to be earthquake resistance, which wasn't originally thought to be an issue. And then even for this tower, they couldn't make it light enough using concrete and stone cladding to sit on the foundation. So we were asked actually to look at a steel tower, which would then have stone cladding on it to make it light enough to sit on there. But we came up instead with the idea of using a post-tensioned stone panel, so making it only stone, no concrete, so that it was self-finished and we could make it thin enough and light enough to work. And we invented a whole industrial process of assembly using computer-controlled saws to cut the stones, and a site, off-site assembly yard where these panels, which are 5 metres by 3 metres, are made, and then brought to site and hung. Because the other thing that happens as you complete the job, the amount of site area available for construction diminishes, because you build more and more and you've got less and less open space. So you have to try and move to this idea of doing more work off-site. Anyway, so long story short, we've come up with a system where the speed of construction is 10 times what it used to be. Yeah, the cost of construction is similar to what it used to be. And they now have an ambition to finish the church in 10 years' time, in 2026, which will be 100 years after Gaudi died. So,
and
the pleasure I get from
that's,
you know,
very
those
special
last 3 years, is
knowing it will be there forever. Okay, last question.
Yeah.
Thinking about young engineers, and hopefully many women these days, because I assume that you very much encourage that, and there's a shortage of engineers, particularly female engineers. What advice would you give to someone wanting to come into this profession?
I think my advice would be to think widely, to care about humanity and society's needs, you know, at the big highest possible level, to be creative, not just logical, to have empathy and communication skills, ideally, because the computers are going to become more and more intelligent tools that do a lot of what an engineer traditionally did do, and our job is harnessing that, you know, what's going to become an infinite sort of possibilities, you know, in the right way. So it's all about the what do people really need, what should we be doing, and how do we do it, rather than the actual doing of it.
Because the doing of it will be hived off to artificial intelligence.
In effect, yes.
So it's about using your emotions, heart, yes. soul much more.
You still have to care about all the logic. You still have to understand the logical, numerical side of it, because you can't harness the tool properly without that understanding. But you don't have to spend your time actually doing sums anymore.
Well, that's a perfect note to end on. Tristram Carfrae, thank you very much.